Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool is on Teams, I believe. Representative Wool, are you there?
Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster, and let's see here, Representative, okay, I think that's that for now. And just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. Today we'll have a presentation from the Department of Health and Social Services on Medicaid. And so this is a follow-up to our prior meeting that we had. It was a fairly abbreviated meeting. And so here to present are Deputy Commissioner Albert Wall, Assistant Commissioner Sylvan Robb, and Director of Behavioral Health, Jennifer Moreau Johnson. And then online presenters are Ted Helvoy Evergreen, Vice President of Evergreen Economics, and Richard Albertoni of Public Consulting Group. And so with that, Deputy Commissioner Wall, Assistant Commissioner Robb, and Director Moreau Johnson, if you could go ahead and come on up to the table here and put yourselves on the record and begin with your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Medicaid and Healthcare Services for the Department of Health and Social Services. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very pleased to be here today. Thank you for the invitation to discuss this important topic.
Just gonna get your mic a little bit.
Am I not projecting through my mask? There we go. This afternoon, we're going to discuss Medicaid, its enrollees, its costs, and its future. And I think we're all aware that Medicaid is an immense and complex topic, and so it's going to cover an array of issues. Really, the ones that we're focusing on are issues that have been asked by the chair, and so we're going to focus on them a little bit. I know there's a lot more in Medicaid than what is just in this presentation. We've assembled a number of subject matter experts. So if you have any questions at all, even if it doesn't appear in the presentation, please feel free to ask. I have online the Director of Healthcare Services, Renee Gayhart, the Director of Senior and Disability Services, John Lee, the Director of Public Assistance, Shonda O'Brien, and in the room with me, Director of Behavioral Health, Jennifer Moreau Johnson. All of them are specialists in their area. This is the agenda for the meeting. I know we have a lot of information to cover. I will be presenting a brief overview of Medicaid. I don't want to insult anybody's intelligence. I just want to get as grounded as to what we're talking about. We'll talk a little bit about eligibility and what that means. I'll be followed by Assistant Commissioner Sylvan Robb, who will do a presentation on the budget. Dr. Helvoit from Evergreen Economics, who was mentioned, we'll give a presentation on the projected costs of Medicaid in the future, how we determine those projections, what they're likely to be, and how those costs can be contained. And then Rich Albertoni, who is a consultant with Public Consulting Group, has been working with the department to put together a roadmap for cost containment for the future. He's going to discuss some of the things that he's put in that roadmap that the department should implement in order to do cost containment. And Director Moreau Johnson will do a presentation focused on the 1115 behavioral health waiver. It was authorized under Senate Bill 74, fully implemented under Governor Dunleavy, and so we now have a little bit of a track record and data on that program. The 1115 waiver has substantively and positively impacted the delivery of behavioral health care in the state, and it has simultaneously reformed the payment system. And so we better capitalize on federal money, reduce the general fund, continue to provide access to a more comprehensive system of care than before. Now, we've arranged this flow of topics, and hopefully it makes sense to you. It's kind of logical to me. The flow of topics is Medicaid, its cost and budget, how we determine those costs for the coming year and future, ways we can contain those costs, and then an example of a cost containment program, one among many.
And I'd just like to note for the record, we've been joined by Representative Rasmussen. Please continue.
I realize that the schedule this morning is ambitious, and there's a number of small presentations in the big presentation, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I think I mentioned before, if you have any questions, please ask. We have assembled this crack team of experts to answer as many questions as possible in this setting today. Without further ado, Medicaid is the largest health coverage program in Alaska. It has over 250,000 enrollees and $2.4 billion in expenditures. It provides comprehensive health care, and that comprehensive health care is based on the needs of the enrollee. And while we often speak as Medicaid as a unified giant program, we should be aware that it takes specialized units to run this giant program. They must administer and manage individual pieces of Medicaid in order to make it work. Many different states handle this differently. In our state, we basically have four divisions that are operational for Medicaid. At the subcommittee meetings, we've been doing presentations on the budgets of those divisions. And I just want to take a second to point out, those presentations are on the operational budget of that division, obviously. This presentation is on the larger Medicaid expenditure, which those divisions have to enact. It doesn't appear in their budget.
And I'll just note also for the record, we've also got Representative Carpenter online. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Medicaid is a collaborative effort, and I'll just start out at the door of Medicaid, which we see as the Division of Public Assistance. They handle eligibility determinations for the state. Anybody who applies goes through their process. And again, they're eligible based on need, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means for the future. But for the vast majority of people who come on Medicaid, what that means is primary care. To see how that operates, I'll talk to you about it in this way. Primary care usually is talking about services performed at hospitals and physician clinics and so on and so forth. Those services are managed and have regulatory oversight through healthcare services, which is a division of our department. They handle all the claims, they do all the surveys and checks on those facilities, and that is their purvey, kind of primary care. There are other services they offer, but that's the biggest one. There are also Alaskans who need a different type of service. Perhaps they need some behavioral health care. And those Alaskans may be eligible for services under the 1115, and that includes things like mental health treatment, perhaps substance abuse treatment, and those are handled through the Division of Behavioral Health. And the kind of the third arm of operations are those Alaskans who are eligible for services that are tailored to individuals with disabilities, seniors, and vulnerable adults, and those qualify for services under the Senior and Disability Services waivers, of which there's more than one, and we can talk about that if you'd like. Another thing I would point out, just as a matter of course, is Medicaid has two fiscal agents in the state of Alaska. Some states have many more. Some states have only one. Right now we have two. We have Optum, which is our fiscal agent for the Behavioral Health 1115 waiver, and we have Conduit, which is basically our fiscal agent for everything else. It's divided that way for one reason. The 1115 waiver, is a program that was put in place that it has to be proven to the federal government. So it has its own timeline, it has its own outcomes, and we have to manage that very closely so that our reporting mechanism to the feds is done correctly. And so we have those two, for one reason, we have those two processes. I also take just a second to point out that Medicaid has all this little nuance and complexity within it that has units performing very specific, very important tasks that without them we could not operate Medicaid. Many times these people don't get a whole lot of kudos in public because they're very small shops, they're doing a very specific task, and many of them don't even really have a division director that can come up to the table and brag about the work that they do. And I just want to take a minute to tell you the people in these shops, Alaska could not exist without as we see it today. The reality is the work they do is behind the scenes, It's done humbly, and I am very proud to work with them and appreciative of their efforts. And I'll roll through these pretty quick. Finance and Management Services has the Federal Reporting Claiming and Audit Unit. It's under Assistant Commissioner Robb. It's headed by Linnea Osborne. Just to give you a little bit of scale as to what I'm talking about, a small unit does, that organization, that little bit of unit, is really responsible for drawing down about $1.7 billion in federal funds a year. That puts Alaskans to work. It provides health care. Very small unit, and yet an immense amount of impact. And we rely heavily upon them. They do all of our federal reporting, and they handle that portion of money, which is the match from the federal office. The Office of Rate Review is headed by Executive Director Marcy Beach. These folks work with providers across the state individually. They work with the divisions across the department. They are responsible to set fiscally responsible, legal, and sustainable rates for all of our providers. Program Integrity is a unit that oversees enforcing our providers doing the right thing. And so they do audits on our providers, and when they find something wrong, they will pull some of that money back as a form of revenue for the state. This unit under Doug Jones brings in about $5.5 million a year. This is just one unit that handles with fraud. You'll see the one listed here for the Department of Law. In the Department of Law, that Medicaid Fraud Control Unit actually pursues criminal intent cases. So that's another program integrity unit. I also would think, I would be remiss not to say that each division has its own small quality assurance unit, which performs some of this work as well. And they are doing quality assurance over what specifically is in their operation. The Medicaid State Plan Administrator for the state is Courtney King. Whereas the rest on this page have at least a little staff to work with, Courtney is all by herself and does a tremendous job at keeping track of all of the state plan amendments, the conversations that we have with the federal government regarding changes, upcoming changes, and the potential to change within our state plan. Just as a reminder, I often explain Medicaid as a contract between the federal government and the states, and that's exactly what it is. So in this case, the Medicaid State Plan Administrator really is our contract manager for that contract. It's an economy of scale issue because this contract is $2.4 billion, and we have a lot of responsibility to the federal government, but she tracks all of that. Carrie Pekoch is our newest member of the team. She heads up the Health Information Technology team. They're responsible for all of the advanced planning documents for Medicaid. If we're going to make any change at all, it must be approved through CMS, signed off by them, and this office handles that. They also are the contract managers for the Health Information Exchange. And finally, the last one is certainly not least, is the coordination and consultation with the tribal health organizations. So each division has a specified tribal liaison, so they're working at a divisional level with the tribes. We also have commissioner office level designation as well, and a number of different groups that we meet with in tribal health care weekly, biweekly, quarterly, Medicaid Task Force, Alaska Native Health Board. And I would be remiss not to compliment our partners at this point. They have done a tremendous work with us. I personally believe we have a very good relationship with them, and I'm thankful for their perspective on both health care delivery in Alaska and the cost of that delivery, because it's important. I would take an aside just briefly to talk about one of the things that we do under tribal health, which is the tribal reclaiming process, which is handled through healthcare services. Tribal reclaiming is a unit that finds money that was spent that was general fund that could have been claimed under federal funds through tribal health and adjusts that payment, bringing that money back to the state. You'll recall under Senate Bill 74, there were annual targets that were set with that unit. The department's been pretty close to those targets every year. In FY20, we brought in a revenue of $90 million. Again, putting Alaskans to work, providing health care.
Got a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair. Of the departments that were just listed on the prior slide, could you indicate which of these departments the providers would work through if they're having issues on the Medicaid billing system side of things on the state's end?
Absolutely, Representative Rasmussen through the chair. So these, this slide, slide three, represents the four divisions within our department that handle Medicaid, aspects of Medicaid. If the provider is a behavioral health provider, they would work through the Division of Behavioral Health, and there's a contact online and information that goes out through the Medicaid system that informs each one of those providers who their contact is and how they can contact them. If it's anything besides behavioral health, it's healthcare services, and they have the same.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Do you know roughly how many providers, this isn't behavioral health, I guess, for dentists and physicians and all the various different types of medical providers, how many are assigned to one, I don't know what that position is called, that they can go to if they have questions with the forms or reimbursement or anything like that?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, it's a fairly complex question. There's a number of different provider types that are licensed and a different number for each of those. So what I'd like to do, if I can, is just get that list back to you in writing, if you don't mind.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On that same page, could you, Mr. Wall, could you explain to me what a fiscal agent does in relationship to Medicaid?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, yes, thank you. Actually, that was remiss. It's in my notes. I just didn't say it. So a fiscal agent's responsible for claims administration, working with providers on how to file those claims, make sure the claims are done correctly, and actually the payment process of those claims. We work with, as I said, the two vendors to provide that service to our providers. We then go back and work with our vendors on a daily basis to help them coordinate the claims administration, the analysis of those claims, and then we go back and survey all of those claims or audit all of those claims as well. But they actually handle the working with the providers to make sure the claims are correct in a lot of cases, and they handle the money to pay that provider.
And another really rookie question, but the word waiver has always baffled me in relationship to topics like Medicaid and medical services, et cetera. I mean, waiver to me, you know, it's a bad thing if a baseball player gets waived. But I know this is something different. Tell me what a waiver actually is in relationship to Medicaid.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, that's a good example. So I always use the example of this. You have a core set of rules. You have to do one, two, and three. A waiver basically is something that says you don't have to do the core set of rules. You can do one, two, and three, and maybe A and B. So it's just a waiver to the normal set of rules. There's all different kinds of waivers, and it can be very confusing. I apologize, because those of us who are in Medicaid all the time tend to use a lot of numbers and acronyms. I tried to keep them out of this presentation, but the reality is we throw around 1115 waiver like you ought to know what it is, and I apologize for that. Those numbers and letters are sections in the federal code that apply to Medicaid. So when we say 1115 waiver, there's a section 1115 in the federal code that describes what that is. There's many different types of 1115 waivers, which makes it more confusing. Every state has their own unique 1115 waiver. Some of them have more than one, and they do multiple things. So it is difficult. Perhaps it would be better to have nomenclature that had a word on it instead of a number, but in our case, we only have one, so we call it the 1115 waiver. I'm not sure if that's helpful to you, but those numbers have to do with rules that are waived under subsections of the Medicaid rule. I'll give you one that maybe you can recognize just in this current setting, and that is the 1135 waiver. We had a pandemic. We have a pandemic. When that public health emergency first came out, one of the things the state was required to do to avail itself of the public health emergency funding was to file an 1135 waiver. But an 1135 waiver is basically telling the feds, hey, we have an emergency. Can we waive this rule, that rule, and this rule in order to provide better health care and accessibility to health care and make it sustainable during a time of a pandemic? So we waived certain, we're more flexible under certain rules. I think Director Johnson will do a pretty good in-depth talk about what a waiver looks like here shortly.
Thank you very much.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, and this goes back to the splitting of the department into two components. What does this do to arguably the biggest function of the biggest department by far in state government? It's splitting that department into two components, knowing that Medicaid, I think, courses through both of the two agencies, but yet you're going to have the staff primarily housed in one agency and not in the other. I think, and I don't want to belabor things because we have about a week's worth of slides here, not just the 2 hours.
Absolutely.
But I think that, you know, there bears some discussion, even just a tiny bit, if you want to get to it later.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, actually, I'm super happy to talk about that. What we've done in the division of the department is a simple dividing between two points. In my mind, we're dividing the Medicaid program out, its administration, its functions as a regulatory oversight body, and its processing of claims. We're dividing that up from 24/7 care. In my mind, that's the simplest thing. The divisions that are going to the new DFCS are divisions that do not regulate Medicaid. They may use Medicaid as a provider. OCS uses Medicaid, API does in certain cases, so on and so forth. They may use Medicaid, but they're not a regulator of it. In fact, some of the divisions that are left in the Department of Health regulate those other divisions, which is one of the reasons why, in my mind, we're making that change. For instance, Alaska Psychiatric Institute is a hospital. It is licensed as a hospital. It falls under the jurisdiction of healthcare facility licensing out of HCS. They do the surveys and the audits on behalf of CMS in that structure. And they determine whether or not they're compliant with that in that structure. So you have one division in the current department overseeing, regulatory overseeing, another division, which is an interesting arrangement. In the new arrangement, you would have Medicaid peer, no changes to that at all, and 24/7 peer, no changes to that at all. And so they're continue to use Medicaid just the way they are, and Medicaid will continue to regulate and process claims just the way it does. It does allow us more time to focus proactively on the Medicaid side with doing things like cost containment and planning, which has to happen, but in some ways is not happening as fast as it could because of all of the emergencies that we have to manage constantly across the breadth of the department. That's just my two cents.
Just a real quick commentary to allow the Deputy Commissioner to continue on. Both Representative Thompson and I were here when Senate Bill 74 went through. I think it was 2 weeks in this committee that bill went through, the Medicaid bill, back in 2016. And it's very interesting 6 years later now to see, as you described initially, where it's at in the implementation stage of things, because it was a behemoth undertaking then, and everything we're doing right now is still larger than life. But Steve was co-chair back then, and we gave up a good part of our lives on that bill, it seemed like.
Yeah, Representative Edgerman, through the chair, I would say I usually introduce Jen as the best behavioral health director I've ever seen, because in 2016 I was the behavioral health director, and so I have invested a great deal in this as well.
Thank you.
So as mentioned before, eligibility in Medicaid is based on need, and so you have categories of eligibility, and they're on the screen. I'm not going to read through them. I know one or two of them jump out at you, and I'll talk about those in a second, but categories of eligibility have demographics, so they have a baseline averaged age and income and ethnicity and so on and so forth. And we can track the rise and fall or the trending line of those categories. And we can project cost off of those. So just for example, we know that the elderly population in Alaska is growing. So as one of the eligibility groups in Medicaid, that has impact. So what Dr. Helboyd's going to talk about here in a minute is how we use that to project cost and then how we can address that to do some cost containment as well. I know that some interest has been generated over the years around the topic of the expansion group. This next slide shows what Medicaid enrollees and recipients numbers look like. Let me describe to you hopefully how to use this chart real quick. These are unduplicated by group. So I'm a little color challenged, but I'm going to call the bottom right corner green. Those lines in my eyes are green, and the rest of them orange. The green ones represent the Medicaid expansion population. The orange ones represent everybody else. And you have to add those two together to get the total. So I hope that understands, that helps with this description. But you can see the trend lines rising in one place, falling a little bit in another. But overall, the enrollment is growing steadily, but small in a small way. I know there's a lot of interest generated around this topic, in particular because right now we're not able to address issues of eligibility regarding redetermination, and I know we have talked about that. We can't take anybody off the rolls of being eligible, and so our number keeps continue to grow until the public health emergency is over, and then we'll go back to our redetermination process, and that number will come back down. And that's a federal rule that's tied to our federal match. I'm going to stop real briefly in case there's questions on that. Too easy. Excellent. Okay, I'm going to hand the presentation over to Assistant Commissioner Robb, who will talk about the numbers, and I will flip slides.
Thank you. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health and Social Services. So I know there's understandably a great deal of interest in how we come up with the projections for Medicaid each year. And we include a number of variables as we're putting together the projections. Things that Deputy Commissioner Wall was just talking about, like population trends, especially within subsets of the population, looking at utilization and projecting where we think that's going to go. Of course, we look at actual spending trends as we see them in the state's accounting system. And then we make adjustments for things we know are going to be coming that will impact the budget. Any state plan amendments that we may have submitted that come with a fiscal element or any regulation changes that may have an impact on costs of Medicaid. Not surprisingly, our state legislature are not the only ones interested in Medicaid projections. We have to submit a report called the CMS 37 quarterly to the feds because that is our projection tool for them. Those are two-year projections because they are also very interested in what might be spent on Medicaid. Looking into the future. So in addition to taking into account all those variables, we also have a number of resources that we use as we're putting this together. Utilization metrics that are developed based off of numbers we get out of IRIS, as well as the MMIS, which is the fiscal agents that Deputy Commissioner Wall was speaking about. We look at the weekly check writes, which are the amount of checks that go out to providers in exchange for payments every week. We have a short-term forecast tool that Dr. Helvoy produces for us that we look at. During COVID, we've also been producing a COVID projection tool as well, as that's obviously impacted things. And then the MESA, which is the long-term 20-year forecast for Medicaid, also plays into what we come up with for the budget. And Dr. Helvoy will be talking about the MESA here in just a couple slides. Go ahead. So this slide should look very familiar to you. This is the same slide that you saw when Commissioner Crum and I were here last week. And again, just as a reminder, Medicaid has a total budget of $2.4 billion. In FY23, the projected UGF need is $656 million. We are asking for an increment of $45 million for FY23, and we'll get into a little bit more about how we arrived at that number on the next slide. You can see that DGF, other funds, as well as federal funds are all flat relative to FY23 and really have been pretty flat across the time period covered here. Overall, the cost of Medicaid is up slightly during this time period, $73 million, but UGF spend is down $20 million. And the department does work very hard, as Jen will talk about, just one of those efforts to contain the cost of Medicaid. So here we are on slide 9, and just as a reminder, the FY23 budget is built based on the assumption that the enhanced FMAP that the state has been receiving because of the public health emergency declared on a federal level, that will have ended at the end of fiscal year 22. So the assumption is that we will be back to our regular FMAP for FY23. The enhanced FMAP has afforded us about an additional $17.5 million of federal funding for Medicaid each quarter, so that's roughly equal to about $70 million annually. and we will have had the enhanced FMAP for all of fiscal year 22. So as we looked at our projections and worked through things, we were projecting a shortfall of $72 million for Medicaid for FY23 if the department did nothing to try to contain those costs. Obviously, we only ask for $45 million, and that is because we have a number of cost containment efforts that we're planning to implement. I just want to jump out and say, no fear, you do not have people in charge of this who are bad at math. We know that the difference between $72 million and $45 million is 27, and that the items on this slide total to more than that. And the reason for that is because, you know, we have found in the past when we have had cost savings plans that it is best to afford ourselves a little flexibility. The timing doesn't always come out exactly as planned, and this just gives us a little bit of wiggle room, about $5 million. Of, you know, CMS being slow to approve something, so we can't get it implemented on the timeline that we're anticipating. So three of the items that we're counting on here are recommendations from the public consulting group, and we do have Mr. Albertoni on the line. He'll be speaking about those and how he came up with these recommendations. The first one is the $17 million that is projected due to being able to do those eligibility redeterminations. Deputy Commissioner Wall mentioned that since March 18th of 2020, anyone who was enrolled in Medicaid at that point or has subsequently enrolled has not been able to be removed from the eligibility rolls in exchange for receiving that 6.2% enhanced FMAP. There are a few exceptions to that, obviously, if people pass away during that period or they move out of state, or anybody who wants to be taken off the rolls, we can take those actions. But otherwise, everyone who was on back in March of 20 is still enrolled. The second item is $6.5 million, and that's related to implementing Section 1945 health homes. And again, Mr. Albertoni will tell you a little bit more about what those are and what the implementation will look like. And then the final item from the PCG recommendations is $4.6 million savings, $3.5 million, which is related to pay for performance for hospitals. And then the last item is not something that was recommended by PCG, but that we are looking to implement beginning in FY23, and we're anticipating $4.6 million in savings, and that is from starting to implement tribal reclaiming within the fiscal agent for the 1115 waiver. So up till now, we've been busy getting that fiscal agent stood up and working with the contractor, and so in an effort to kind of take bite-sized chunks and work through the kinks of that, we haven't been doing the tribal reclaiming. We are able to do that retroactively current quarter and then seven prior quarters. So. We're looking forward to starting that and reclaiming some additional federal funding that way.
Got a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Back when the administration began in FY20, the department produced for us something called a Phase 1 Cost Containment Implementation Schedule, and it was believed that these cost reductions could be achieved. And that was in defense of cutting the Medicaid budget. Is it possible to get an updated version of that kind of implementation schedule?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if we can talk after the meeting to make sure that we're looking for the document that you're interested in seeing, we can look at getting that updated for you.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll turn it over to our very capable colleague, Dr. Helboy.
Questions, Representative Edgman, then Representative Ortiz.
Yes, so there was discussion earlier about projecting annual Medicaid expenses with the increased emphasis on tribal compacting, as we heard you and the commissioner describe to the committee a few days ago. How does that impact Medicaid expenses? Is there any interrelationship at all with increased tribal activity, or would it just be the same?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, I missed the first couple of words of your question. I apologize.
So when we got the, and the commissioner is in the back, I see, when we got the departmental overview from this committee a few days ago, there was discussion, particularly with OCS, if I remember right, 587 PCNs and so on and so forth, but the need to have more tribal compacting, and that there's going to be emphasis because there need liaisons now involved. And so I just wonder, what's the relationship with Medicaid, and is there any at all with the 1115 waiver, for example, and so on?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, tribal compacting will be an OCS issue. Is an OCS issue. Does not have direct impact on Medicaid. The services that Medicaid offers, some clientele of OCS do participate in and use, but it doesn't have, the compacting will not have direct impact on Medicaid itself.
Just a quick follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up, and just we've got multiple presenters. If maybe you could identify yourself if we switch
right,
back and forth,
I apologize, Mr. Thank Chair.
Thank you so much. Just help with our recording. Representative Edgman.
I think this can be pretty quick. So is that, are you speaking in the present sense, the present term with compacting? Because, you know, in the ideal world, at least in my ideal scenario, tribal compacting would be far more prevalent than it is today. So I just wonder if there would be a future role to have Medicaid be a part of all that. But I'm guessing, Deputy Commissioner, that's probably not being envisioned at this point.
For the record, this is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department, and for the prior statement is mine as well. Representative Edgman, through the chair, I don't believe that there will be direct impact because of compacting. That is a separate issue. However, the services that are provided on by Medicaid to those people will be impacted. We do on Medicaid side consultation. So consultation is an ongoing process, and every change that's substantive in nature, we must consult with the tribes on currently in Medicaid. I mentioned Courtney King earlier, who is our state plan administrator, and she is in charge of that conversation. So every change that takes place in Medicaid, we consult with the tribes on in the specific setting. That's our process for Medicaid.
Okay, I think that's helpful. Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to the slide which had the bar, that one there, yes. And then when I look at that slide, of course, it goes back to 2019. It's basically kind of flat overall spending. It's a little creep up there that's happening. And, of course, when you're talking billions, it's more than just a little, I guess. But my question is, if we were to take a further look back at those bar graphs, like in the previous page or a couple of slides before that, it talks about Medicaid enrollees and recipients, and it includes Medicaid expansion when that was adopted. We've seen a gradual increase in participation in Medicaid, and it seems like the increase in participation doesn't correlate necessarily with a graphic increase in costs going up at the same level. But if we were to go back to 2005 with the same bar graph, would we see that general uptick that we see in enrollment going with costs? Would that generally be the case?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the question you are asking is aligns very closely with the things we asked Dr. Helvoy, and so I think he'll actually answer your question. If you wouldn't mind holding it, if you still have it after you've seen his presentation, we'll be happy to circle back. Oh, and I'm sorry, for the record, Sylvan.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 9 again, just to make sure I'm clear on the last bullet point, you've noted $4.6 million potential savings in more aggressive reclaiming, tribal reclaiming. Is this $4.6 million number used both as a savings in the administrative services organization and separately in the Division of Healthcare Services? Is there a chance the budget reflects that number twice?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, that is we already do tribal reclaiming through the claims that are paid through healthcare services. And then the tribal reclaiming that we're going to be implementing are for those claims that come through for the 1115 waiver through the second fiscal agent. And so we have never implemented tribal reclaiming on those claims to this point. So it is a separate set of numbers.
Mr. May I add, Mr. Chair?
Deputy Commissioner Wall.
For the record, Al Wall. Representative Josephson through the chair. I would also just like to add that one of the reasons why that's true is because the 1115 waiver and its fiscal agent Optum are relatively new, and we had a short period of time in which to get them solid in their process. We introduced their service line on two phases. So the substance abuse piece went first. It was done for a year, and then after that, mental health is added. So we've proactively, very thoughtfully stood that process up so that it functions properly, and we did not add the reclaiming of tribal claims into that process until we knew the process was sound. Now they're ready for it, and we're going to start stepping into it. The other tribal reclaiming is already done through the other fiscal agent conduit on those claims. They're just separate claim groups.
All right, follow up on this? The Division of Healthcare Services apparently has also indicated that tribal reclaiming opportunities are down because of the pandemic and perhaps underutilization. Now that can, of course, boomerang. Of that, but is it possible that the 4.6 million can't be achieved because of less utilization?
Go ahead. We're fighting over who's going to answer. Again, Al Wolf, for the record, Representative Joseph through the chair. I suppose in the world of possibility, I would not rule that out. I suppose something could happen that. That would make that true. As it stands right now, we stand by those projections, and I think they'll come true.
Thank you. Good.
Please continue.
Okay, and with that, we'll turn it over to Dr. Hellboy, who's joining us on Teams, I believe.
And if you could put yourself on the record.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Ted Hellboy, for the record, Ted Hellboy, Vice President of Evergreen Economics. And so as Deputy Commissioner Wall said earlier, if you have questions, please feel free to stop me. I actually can't see you, so if someone physically stop me or verbally stop me and ask this question. So I'm happy to take questions while you go through here. And can you projection okay, voice-wise and such?
Yes, everything's fine.
Okay, great. So let's get going then. So the next slide, I guess, to the stair step slide. All right. So what I'm presenting on today is the long-term forecast of what it, within the department we refer to as the MESA forecast, which Medicaid Enrollment and Spending Alaska that stands for. And it's a long-term forecast that I've been working on for the department since 2005. That original project or that essentially the original project was based on a demand by the legislature to look at the long-term forecast, long-term spending in Alaska. And so that was started in 2005, we presented the results in 2006 to the legislature and then have been updating this each year. And the forecast is a way to let the legislature, let the department know where spending's going, where enrollment's going, utilization and such is going in Medicaid over a long period of time. And it allows, based on the way the department exists or the Medicaid program exists at the time, the given offerings there, the population, the most recent population forecast through the Department of Labor. And so it does not try to guess at what Medicaid may look like in the future. It is based on the program as it exists today. And so, clearly, Medicaid program has changed radically in Alaska and across the U.S. since 2005. But it provides that benchmark to let the department know how things are going and lets the legislature know where costs are going. The forecast, long-term forecast, is a highly structural process of statistical models that begins with population forecast, so the long-term population forecast from Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And then, so we get that right. And then step two is projecting changes in enrollment rates for ends up being 240 different subgroups within the within Alaska, and that's based on gender, based on 12 different age groups, based on Alaska Native and non-Native. And the reason there is, as much as conversation today has been on claiming, so that's important to know what the population looks like with respect to the split for Alaska Native and for non-Natives, and then by region of the state, so five different regions within the state of Alaska. And then next step is to look at utilization of Medicaid services. For this long-term forecast, utilization is slightly different. We refer to, or we mean by utilization is of 20 different service categories that could be used, and a service category would be inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, physician services, and such. Of these 20 different service categories, how many of these different services did a Medicaid enrollee actually utilize? And so, and that's important because this has changed over time. So I have this a little bit off, but right now about on average, each enrollee uses approximately 3.2 different service categories per year. That's increased from say 2.9, 15, 16 years ago. So enrollees are using more varied services than they used to. Next, we look at the intensity of Medicaid services. And so this is essentially, from an economist's point of view, this is the actual real usage of services. And so, and this has grown over time also. And intensity of services could be things that moving from x-rays to CT scans. It could be using physical therapy that didn't exist before. It could be more frequent doctor's offices. It could be greater use of pharmaceuticals and such. So intensity of services has changed. And then finally, step five, kind of quite honestly, the granddaddy of all changes is simply inflation. So how much are prices rising in healthcare, you know, essentially in America, but specifically to Alaska. And this has changed. The way we do this, or the way I do this now, is a little different. We'll talk about it in a few slides, that instead of looking at healthcare price inflation or healthcare price inflation in general, we look at how prices or how reimbursement rates have changed over time and how they're projected to change within the Medicaid program. And there's some really good news on that part. So next slide. So before getting into the all the nitty-gritty of the forecast results, I have several slides on essentially what's going on today. And so in this slide, is looking from all of fiscal year 2020, all of fiscal year 2021, and part of fiscal year, the current fiscal year 2022, and looking at weekly spending based on data service. So, and simply by looking at spending based on data services, which week the actual week the service was received, regardless of when it was paid. And so those services might be paid in 30 days, they might be paid in 60 days, 90 days, whatever it might be. We're looking at date of service, which is different from date of payment, which is essentially when it got paid, regardless of when a service occurred. And so for different purposes, we use date of service or date of payment. For the long-term forecast, we focus on date of service for the most part. And so the blue dots represent where weekly Medicaid spending based on date of service was going. Then we had the COVID emergency, and spending dropped precipitously as many appointments, non-urgent appointments, were canceled. And that has trended back up, and so that we're spending is approximately back to where it was before. It's not the same level as it was before, but it's getting there. For the long-term forecast, and I'm sticking by, for the moment anyway, sticking by the idea that COVID emergency and this pandemic is a blip is the wrong word, but it is it's a detour on this overall long-term forecast. So it's impacted it, but it is not a it's not does not have a 20-year impact. It's a much shorter impact for the on the forecast. Next slide, please. And this is looking at enrollment. So growth in enrollment month over, so annualized or monthly annualized or annualized monthly growth in enrollment. So looking at July 2018 to July 2019, July 2019 to July 2020 on and such. And so you see that with the emergency enrollment increase, the rate of growth in enrollment increased all the way through July of 2021, so this past July. And Assistant Commissioner Rob mentioned this in her presentation, that this is due to, this is not necessarily that there's greater demand at all for Medicaid, but rather that people can come on to Medicaid, but you essentially have to move or die to get off of Medicaid. And so in the past, there's been churn that's gone both directions. And today, the churn is mostly in one direction, is people come on Medicaid. There's fewer ways to come off of Medicaid. And that will change, ideally, in the future. As you can see, it peaks, and now it starts declining because now we're well over a year into the emergency, and so the growth has to decline at this point. Next slide, please. And this slide, a little bit complicated, but this is perhaps my favorite slide in the whole presentation. And Deputy Commissioner Wall addressed this earlier with a focus on what we refer to regular Medicaid versus expansion, but this is not looking, does not look at that division, but rather looking at GF spending versus federal spending. And so the bars, so the blue-red bars, are from fiscal year 2012 to fiscal year 2021, is total spending on Medicaid services each year. And again, based on data services. So total spending on Medicaid services each year, as you can see, it started increasing very rapidly when Medicaid expansion began, and has since slowed. It declined in fiscal year 2020 due to the fourth quarter of the fiscal year with the pandemic, and now it's coming back up, but still relatively low. So that's the bars, that's spending, and the blue bars is for legislature particularly important. That's what the state is spending, and it is important to note that spending is, from the state's point of view, is a little bit less than it was 10 years ago. So that's a positive. And then this addresses one of the questions. This is a partial address to one of the questions of earlier, and one of the issues that Deputy Commissioner Wall mentioned. The green line in the chart is showing, I'm looking on the side here, the green line is showing enrollment, Medicaid enrollment, and the blue line is showing Medicaid recipients. And so a very important distinction that doesn't seem very important, in maybe one conversation, but is critically important, is that recipients and enrollees are two different things. So an enrollee is anyone who is enrolled in Medicaid. A recipient is someone who is enrolled in Medicaid and utilized Medicaid services. And in this case, because we're looking at annual data and based on annual unduplicated counts, your recipient, from my accounting, your recipient, if you use at least $10 worth of Medicaid in a year. And so there's some very low users in here also, but that is kind of just a simple measure of, are you a recipient or not? So the important thing that this chart is showing is that just looking at 2012 to today, there's been a much greater growth in enrollees than there has been in recipients. And this difference that you see in 2012 is about what it was in 2005 and earlier fiscal years, in some cases maybe even slightly closer. And before the ACA, and certainly before the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, the reevaluation of Medicaid eligibility was done much more frequently. It was done, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe on a quarterly basis or such. And so the churn was much greater back then. People came onto Medicaid because they were eligible. people left Medicaid because they were no longer eligible. And then with ACA, people could come into Medicaid in more ways than before through the no wrong door part of the ACA. And so we started getting greater division between separation between the number of enrollees in Medicaid and the number of recipients. And so we and so today I do have it on there. Actually, I don't have it on there. But today, so in fiscal year 2022, approximately 78% of Medicaid enrollees are also recipients. So the rest, those 22% of all enrollees, aren't even using services at all. So, and so enrollment has increased and become not the best measure of the program. It's really the recipient count. Next slide, please. Okay, so that's kind of like current events and what things are looking like, some important things, but that wasn't the forecast. Now the forecast. So population, our first step of the forecast. Population growth in Alaska has been slow the last decade or so, and it's going to continue to be slow. And again, this is the state's official forecast from 2020. Between 2022 and 2042, the state is projected to increase in population by less than 0.5% per year. On a percentage basis, the growth is going to be much greater with seniors, so 65 and older, and the slowest growth is going to be with children, so 0 to 19 years of age. And so that has, as you might imagine, as we'll discuss here further, that has big implications for the Medicaid program. Because the spending patterns are much different for based on age. Next slide, please. And this is another slide that I have included in the Mesa report each year for a number of years now. And I think it's especially important for legislatures and for to kind of understand where the Medicaid program has been and where it's going into the future. And so going back to fiscal year 2000, the number of enrollees in the Medicaid program was around 90,000. Now we're pushing 260, and we're going to be it's going to be 300,000 plus by 2042. So it has seen a lot of growth. And again, this is enrollees, not recipients, just enrollees. It's seen a lot of growth, and it's going to continue to grow. And then the other really important the thing that this graph shows is that in the past, children were the main main enrollees. And with Medicaid expansion, that has shifted. And it's working age adults are the largest enrollment group within Medicaid. Next slide, please. All right. So I mentioned earlier, as do the forecast, it's started the population, enrollment, step. That last step is, in the past, has been to essentially to add on medical price inflation to the forecast. And this forecast differs in that while in the past, using medical price inflation seems intuitively correct because as prices increase for healthcare overall, regardless of the price that is charged to Medicaid, my assumption was that prices are going to increase at the same rate. And I did a lot more work on this area for this forecast and discovered over the last 15 years that has not been the case, reimbursement rates for Medicaid have been much slower and sometimes flat as opposed to the overall general price inflation for healthcare. And so, my personal opinion is that can't continue at that level in the future. And so, whereas the blue line is showing projection of overall medical price inflation in Alaska, the red dash projects the increase in growth in reimbursement rates to providers of Medicaid. And so that to maintain a rich, diverse number of providers, reimbursement rates are going to have to increase. I don't think they're going to increase at the same rate as medical price inflation, but they will increase over time. This really is a really important thing for understanding cost controls. I could actually, add more data in there to look back at what happened over the last 15 years. And a lot of this has to come back to that early first couple of MESA forecasts, where before that first MESA forecast, costs were increasing in Medicaid 13, 14, 15, 16% per year. Cost controls were put in by the department and worked on with the legislature, and costs started decreasing. So growth in costs started decreasing. So things were rising at a much lower rate than before.
I had a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Dr. Helvoit, are you retained in part to make recommendations as how to draw the blue line closer to the red line or vice versa? I mean, for example, are you looking at levers to utilize like withholding of inflation, of course, would have the opposite effect, but how are we, you've said essentially that this isn't sustainable, and we see the pattern growing. You're using, I guess, a 4.2% evergreen economic projected growth rate. Is that what Evergreen uses?
Through the chair, Representative Jefferson. So let me do this in two parts. So I think the answer would be no. I would not provide guidance on how can you increase the growth and reimbursement rates for sure. It's more of a case of the here's what the data reveal, and on the reimbursement rates, this is the department's own published data. So to look at reimbursement rates for a particular service in 2005, 10, 15, 20, and then calculate the growth rate. So on that for that service, and then do that for another service. So you have a representative, large representative sample of services. What this is based on. So that's one. That's to get to that red line. The blue line is based on, within the CPI, that is reported for it's all urban. The Anchorage Metro all urban CPI has the medical services component. And so that's historical data. But that trends very well with national overall price inflation. It grows faster, but trends with it grows faster. And so using develop an estimate for that blue line, simply looked at the historical 20 plus years of the rate of medical price inflation for Alaska compared to the overall U.S. General price inflation. Looked at that over the last 20 years, and then, and I'll tell you in a moment why I did that, and then using a third party, so I believe it's economy.com or Global Insights, essentially, Global Insights, projection of overall U.S. inflation, use that to project what healthcare price inflation is going to look like in Alaska into the future. And the reason I used the U.S., which would not be my number one, comparison, but the U.S. general price inflation to Alaska medical price inflation. But the why I needed to use that was because that is a series that is forecasted. So I needed to use a series that is forecasted, and that's probably the most forecasted price inflation series in the world. And so use that. Simply as an instrument to extend or to project medical price inflation in Alaska.
Quick follow-up. What is Evergreen's projected growth rate?
Through the chair, for medical price inflation or for
medical price inflation?
Medical price inflation. It's actually pretty close to 4%. I may be I don't have it right in front of me, but I get that. But it's going to be somewhere between, on average over that whole period of time, 3.5 to 4.2%.
And follow up, it's my understanding that the 10-year outlook for the administration calls for 1% growth in Medicaid. Do I have that right? Do you know, Dr.
Hill? No, through the chair, I do not know what that is. But that gets back to my point, though, is that over the last 15 years, medical price inflation has grown at this rate or even faster, yet the overall spending on Medicaid has lagged behind that. And so the after you factor out for the Medicaid program, for the last Medicaid program, after you factor out changes in population, changes in demographics, changes in enrollment, changes in utilization of services and intensity of use, the what's left over has grown at a much slower rate than overall medical price inflation in Alaska. In other words, those costs have been strongly contained, and then this additional analysis I did this year that looked at reimbursement rates for a large number of services. Excuse me. I don't like to use the word prove, but supports the idea that that the prices paid, so reimbursement rates for Medicaid services, has grown much slower than overall price inflation in Alaska.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Next slide, please. Essentially kind of bring it all together, and this is a very abbreviated version of this. I think it's important, I will throw this in here just because there's so much reported even today on it. The development of this forecast, took our Federal Reserve at their word that inflation is transitory. I think everyone's, it may be transitory based on your definition of transitory, but I'm increasingly worried that overall general price inflation is high general price inflation is going to be with us, which is going to further impact healthcare price inflation. Nevertheless, over this next 20-year period, my projection is that spending on the Medicaid program is going to increase about 3.5% per year. It's going to be substantially faster for the state, and that is simply because right now the state is getting this additional 6.2% FMAP. That will, it keeps getting bumped down another three months, but it's going to go away. It's going to go away at some point. That change is going to lead to the overall what appears to be a much stronger growth in state spending, about 4.2% versus federal spending, about 3.3%. But overall, that the program is going to increase by about 3.5% per year.
And I think this goes back to Representative Josephson's comment about the administration in the 10-year outlook has projected that the cost would go up by about 1%, but you're saying we should expect more like around 3.5%, at least for this portion of healthcare. Is that correct?
Through the chair, it is. And so I think it's really important to point out that the I'm not familiar with that forecast, and my work the department has year in, year out has I've been independent to do my work. So I don't know how those two relate to each other.
I should probably maybe direct that question maybe more to Deputy Commissioner Wall and terms of the forecast that the administration has. Maybe there's some caveat that we're not thinking of. Maybe there's other costs that are going to be down, or is that a fair comment?
Representative Foster, Mr. Chair, I think it would be good to have that dialogue. I'm struggling a little bit to figure out which projection of cost the committee is discussing around 1%. Is that the overall cost of medical, or is that our reimbursement cost for Medicaid?
And that would be the overall cost, correct, Representative Josephson?
That's my memory, but I stand to be corrected. What is the department projecting for Medicaid growth?
In the interest of time, Mr. Chair, may I? Perhaps we can come up with a very specific question and respond to that in writing for you so that we have
Perfect.
It clear and quick.
Perfect. Thank you. Please continue with the presentation.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So this is the first of three slides, kind of set of three slides on essentially on bending the cost curve. And so on each one of these slides, the red line is going to represent history. So history through 2005. Excuse me, through 2005. The green line represents The red line represents actual spending. The green line represents projected spending, and then the blue dotted line represents projected spending from that original 2005-2006 forecast. And so when that forecast came out, obviously we only had data through 2005, and our projection was that Medicaid was going to increase as it looks with the blue dots right there. And so in that forecast was based on population forecast, the state's population forecast as was that day, growth in Medicaid enrollment, based in the utilization of growth in utilization of the services, and intensity of use of services, and most importantly, the medical price inflation, how fast service or spending was increasing for services. And so the important thing here is that did not happen. And those first years after the blue dotted line, that is the most remarkable part, or the most apparent part of this bend in this cost curve, of how small changes have impacted spending on Medicaid, and that so that we're at a point where this green line, the green dashed line, the forecast is well below that original forecast. So that's slide one. So next slide, please. Now thinking of this with respect to recipients, and I will say back then our focus was on enrollees, not recipients. We only forecast enrollees and only kind of didn't really care that much about recipients per se, because the count of recipients and count of enrollees was so close. And in this case, so the same situation, the red is reality. The blue dash is our forecast from that 2005, 2006, and then the green dash is our forecast of recipients as we have today. And you can see that the number of recipients, is very close, was very close for quite a while to the forecast. And then with expansion, you can see it increase quite a bit, beginning in 2015, approximately 2015, fiscal year 2016, really. Our forecast for recipients is going to be much greater than our original forecast. The first bend in the cost curve was overall spending, much lower than we projected originally. The second graph shows that we have many fewer recipients than we thought. Next slide, please. On a per recipient basis, the department is spending far less than we projected back in 2005, 2006. So once again, the red represents actual spending per Medicaid recipient. The blue dots represents our projection from 2005 to 2006. And then finally, the green dash is our projection today, that things will start growing a little bit faster, but this is, and this is maybe the most apparent way or most perfect way to show that benefit of the cost curve by seeing that on a per recipient basis, costs have been pretty flat over the last 10 plus years. Right. Any questions before I move on to the next section here, last section?
Representative Edgman.
Wouldn't that be some validation that a Medicaid expansion actually helps bend the cost curve down?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman. No, I don't think so. I take a step back. So on a per recipient basis, to the extent that that individual within the expansion population that receives services, that their average spending is less than the average of the regular Medicaid folks. Yes, and so it probably is a little bit because that by definition, the expansion population is working age adults that are not disabled. And so if they were disabled, they would have been already eligible for Medicaid. So that probably has helps on this last chart, this third chart with respect to spending per recipient, modest change, but certainly would not on the overall spending that even with Medicaid expansion, or without Medicaid expansion, total spending would be less just because it'd be fewer people. So, hope that
Mr. Wall has a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Al Wall. And just to add a little bit, not at all to correct, because Dr. Hellwood is much smarter than I, but the real money is, or the real difference is in the general fund spend. So there is a tremendous difference in the expansion population among general fund spend, and there has been a tremendous reduction in general fund spend due to the expansion population, but the overall spend is about the same because the federal money's added in.
That's intuitive because on the expansion population, it's what, 90%, 90 to 10, initially started at 100%, if I remember right, way back when, that it graduated at 90%.
Yeah, Representative Edgman through the chair, it stepped down over a couple of years, yes.
But the cost curve itself through the chair, the overall cost curve would be pretty difficult to bend in a place like Alaska where things are pretty expensive, right? Is that another just sort of fact of life?
Representative Edgman through the chair, this is Al Wall for the record. From my perspective, we're really having a conversation around the inflation of medical cost, not necessarily just what we reimburse for Medicaid. We naturally keep our costs low as we can for Medicaid because we have a limited resource in Alaska. The inflation costs appear to be running away at quite a bit over the overall costs, and so those are costs that I think we need to address. I would take just a minute to plug the EO again, if I may, shamelessly, and just say that part of the reason why I think it's important to put Medicaid all in one place away from other distractions is that we can have the discussion around overall medical costs and include the division of insurance and include retirements and benefits and include all of those costs for medical cost inflation and come up with a plan to reduce that cost, because that's as important to Alaska as it is to the nation.
Yeah, so I think like everybody else, I'm getting a little tripped up by this inflation discussion because I hear the 1% rate, which may be more the actuality versus the 4.5% and other numbers, but the projections don't. I mean, if we use 1% going forward, that would bend that curve down a little bit, would it not?
Again, Representative Edgman through the chair, I'm going to probably wait until I see what that 1% is that we're talking about. I'm not sure exactly what that's tied to, but I think we'll be able to. We'll discuss it fully when we can see it.
Thank you. I don't know.
Representative Josephson.
So, Ledge Finance Division, in preparing their long-term outlook, the governor's 10-year plan indeed noted that the administration anticipated agency operations at 1.5% over that span, and Medicaid at 1%. That's that's helpful. Thanks.
Please continue.
Right. So thank you. And then let me, real quick comment on inflation. So the when we talk about inflation in this case, it's the price of a thing, of a service, not the overall spending. So so it is it's priced it's a price inflation as opposed to just increases in spending. And obviously greater higher inflation is going to lead to greater spending in the future, but separate, it's kept in the forecast separate from increases in enrollment, increases in utilization such of services. All right, next slide. So we can make a little bit of a switch here in the presentation, and over, I think this is the third year now of the forecast, there's been a desire by the department to more fully use the data available to us to try to understand spending in Alaska in Medicaid program. And so increasingly, the MESA forecast focuses on chronic conditions. So it looks at chronic conditions and diagnosis within the Medicaid program and spending by recipients that have a diagnosed chronic condition versus spending by those without a diagnosed chronic condition. And so this next, these last, I think it's three slides that I have are focused on chronic conditions. So in this first slide, the horizontal axis is age group. So under 15, 15 to 24, 25 to 34 onward. Then the vertical axis is number of recipients, Medicaid recipients. And so as you see for the under 15, a lot of Medicaid recipients that are under 15 years of age. The blue represents recipients that do not have a diagnosed chronic condition, and the orange is with a diagnosed chronic condition. As you might imagine, for children and for younger adults, the proportion with a chronic condition is relatively small, and as we get to higher age groups, the proportion with a chronic, even though the overall counts are going down, the proportion with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions is actually increasing. And so that, the idea here is that chronic conditions, the likelihood of the incidence of chronic conditions does increase with age. And what's really important about this is, next slide, please. So in this slide, we see on this case, the horizontal axis is recipients with no diagnosed chronic conditions. And then the next slide is diagnosed with one chronic condition, two, and on, all the way up to seven or more chronic conditions. And the orange bar represents total spending on, excuse me, the orange bar represents total spending on Medicaid services for those recipients. And so just taking that first bar, there is 140,000 recipients with no diagnosed chronic conditions. Their total spending that is you have to go all the way to the right vertical axis to see that spending, and it's around $450 million. Then the blue line represents the average spending per recipient, and you can see that for those almost 141,000 recipients, average spending per recipient was just over $3,000. And that is a marketable difference from the next graph, or the next bar. That bar is recipients diagnosed with one chronic condition. There is about 20,000 of them. Their average spending, Medicaid spending, was just over $24,000, and their total spending was pushing $500,000. Real small on my screen here. And then onward and onward. And so as you can see, that as you increase the number of recipients with one chronic condition is far smaller than the number with zero chronic conditions. Those with two chronic conditions is smaller than one, on. But the spending on those recipients increases with each additional chronic condition. And this is of the full-on driver of Medicaid spending is chronic conditions. And chronic conditions, although more prevalent as you get older, we have many more things to, we have all, a lot more life in us to pick up a chronic condition. What's interesting is spending on chronic conditions, if you have a chronic condition, it's really relatively independent of age. So a 75-year-old with one chronic condition costs the Medicaid program about as much as a 25-year-old with one chronic condition. The difference is the likelihood of a 75-year-old having a chronic condition is much greater. The prevalence is greater than 25-year-olds. But so next slide. The end result is that, and so in this chart, our forecast 2022 through 2042, the orange represents beneficiaries or recipients with no chronic conditions. The blue represents with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. Today, most of the spending is on that minority of recipients that have one or more chronic conditions, and relatively little is spent on the majority of recipients that have no diagnosed chronic conditions. That's going to continue into the future. And today, about 80%, so four of every $5 spent on Medicaid services goes to recipients with one or more chronic conditions. By 2042, that's going to increase to from $80, or let's call it 80 cents per dollar, to 84 cents per dollar. And so we are increasingly, the program is increasingly being driven by the expenses associated with chronic conditions. All right, and that's all I have. There's other questions. I'm happy to address those.
Okay, before we move to the next presentation, are there any questions?
Just a quick observation.
Sure, Representative Edgman.
So these numbers also, of course, project forward Alaska's prison population and their need for Medicaid. That's built into the projections.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, to the extent that an incarcerated individual is on the Medicaid rolls, they would be in the data I'd be analyzing, and they'd certainly be in the population data because it includes incarcerated and such. So, I hope that answers the question.
I think it does through the co-chair, and it's also just interesting as a side note to observe that Alaska's population continues to get older and not younger. And that's something to keep an eye on. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your presentation. We'll move on to the next presentation, unless, Deputy Commissioner, you have any comments before we move to the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Albertoni, if you could put yourself on the record.
Rich Albertoni from Public Consulting Group.
And let's see here. Maybe can you say a few words just to make sure we can hear you okay?
Yes. Good evening, everyone.
Okay.
Rich Albertoni from Public Consulting Group. Can you hear me okay?
Perfect. We can hear you better now. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rich Albertoni. I am with Public Consulting Group, and I'm here to talk to you today about an Alaska Medicaid strategy report that I authored for the department under a contract with DHSS. Let me start by telling you a little bit about Public Consulting Group. The firm is based in Boston. We focus on consulting to state and local governments. In Medicaid, we have a health practice area, and we are engaged with, at any one time, about 80% plus of Medicaid programs and some sort of policy or operational component. We do have a few other contracts with Alaska DHSS. We have employees all over the country. I'm speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin today. My own, just a little bit of background about me. I had a 20-year state employee career with the state of Wisconsin, about half of that in the state Medicaid program, and then I joined PCG in 2011. So I'm starting with slide 26. And just want to start by telling you the scope of work that shaped the paper that I wrote. And the key words in this slide are really global roadmap and lower cost. The department was asking me and the PCG team to basically come up with a plan that could redesign the Medicaid program to improve, to have better outcomes, to lower cost, all of those elements. So we'll move on to slide 27. And I just want to show you a little bit about the methodology that was used to shape the paper. So three columns here. In the left column is information about site visits and engagements directly with the department and department staff that occurred over the course of the project. In the middle column, engagement with stakeholders, which was very significant for this project, including this past summer, in the summer of 2021, had several presentations to stakeholder groups on the draft paper, draft ideas in the paper, and used the reactions in those sessions to shape the final paper, which was put together this fall. And then on the right side, just the value add that PCG brings to this with our engagements in so many states. We do have a sense of state best practices in many of these areas and can reflect that in the paper. We'll move on to slide 28.
Got a question, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, so did all the stakeholder engagement, did this feed into the splitting the department into two separate departments? Was it a conversation that was one and the same, or was it independent of the splitting of the department?
Mr. Albertoni, I can take that if you'd like.
Please.
Mr. Wall.
Mr. Chair, this is Al Wall again for the record. They were separate conversations. The PCG conversation actually started prior to the pandemic. It was interrupted a little bit by the pandemic, but it's been ongoing for a number of years now. Separate conversation from the division of the department.
So just to clarify then, the conversation to separate the department happened independently from the review that this process was involved.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, they certainly informed each other, but we were not asking PCG as a recommendation as to whether or not to separate the department, if that's what you're asking.
Perhaps maybe to the co-chair, I will have a better understanding of that as we continue on to the slide presentation. But just off the top, from a layperson's perspective, it seemed like you very much want to have the conversations be had one and the same, given the size of Medicaid, $2.4 billion, $656 million, whatever, and UGF, and all of our efforts to try to contain costs and so forth. And splitting the department is done to make things more efficient as well, perhaps not so much to save money, but to make provide better programmatic representation, if I remember right. But it just seems to me that I guess I will, sit and listen and learn more, but I'm struggling with the fact that those conversations would not sort of be intertwined.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, as I mentioned, they did inform each other. The reason why I'm not giving...
Pardon me, that's not the point I was making, not informed, happening, real time together. But there's a distinction there, and I don't mean to be so abrupt, but I don't want my words to be sort of thrown back at me in a different manner than what I conveyed.
Mr. Wall?
Understood. Representative Edgman, through the chair, didn't mean to misconstrue what we were saying. Our conversations occurred at the same time, in parallel. They did inform each other as to what we would be doing in the future, but Mr. Albertoni was not hired to determine whether or not we should divide the department, if that's what you are asking.
And Commissioner Crum would like to make a comment. Commissioner, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Commissioner Adam Crum, Department of Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, Mr. Albertoni with PCG had specific items that he was working on to see which items that work across the country would work in Alaska for Medicaid cost containment. As we do pay him by the hour as a consultant, his meetings that he came forward was to share with stakeholder groups across the state saying these particular items, what would it look like in the Alaska Medicaid program? As D.C. Wall earlier mentioned in the presentation, the Medicaid program is such a large, giant beast that it is a massive collaborative process. The items Mr. Albertoni addressed were specific program types working with these stakeholder groups to see, will X, Y, and Z work in Alaska, and what would this mean? Please give us your feedback. At the same time, we did have separate conversations about the proposed reorganization with all of these groups listed to make sure that they understood what this is. And so those were conversations that did work together, but Mr. Albertoni has specific tasks, sir. I hope that helps answer the question.
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Albertoni, please continue.
Thank you. I'm on slide 28 now, which is titled Overall Reform Principles. And so these are the principles that the paper is organized around. And basically, they represent the roadmap. And the roadmap is really largely revolves around continuing to move away from the fee-for-service system. And we're going to talk about why I understand the historical nature of the fee-for-service system and why it has been challenging to move away from it in Alaska. But payment reform and delivery system reform are really together moving away from the fee-for-service system. Delivery system reform, I do just want to say what that term means. It is basically the way that Alaska provides healthcare, the way that any state provides healthcare to a recipient. You can do it through a health plan. You can do it directly as a Medicaid program by fiscal agents who reimburse claims. You can use certain kind of care coordination entities, but that's what that term means. So the principles are basically centered around moving away from fee-for-service and then containing costs through program integrity initiatives and making sure that you're claiming all the federal revenue for which you're eligible. We can move on to slide 29. All right, so there were three initiatives that the department included in the budget that I do want to speak to and explain. One is running Medicaid eligibility determinations, redeterminations after the public health emergency ends. The second one is a delivery system reform, implementing health homes, specifically as they are envisioned under Section 1945 of the Affordable Care Act. I'll talk about that. And then beginning payment reforms, starting with hospitals, moving into setting aside a small amount of the hospital budget overall for pay-for-performance initiatives. So I'm going to talk through each one of those. Moving on to slide 30, speaking to the redeterminations first. So as was mentioned earlier, all state Medicaid programs as part of the public health emergency have been unable to remove an individual from being a recipient unless they move out of state, obviously unless they ask to be removed from the rolls or if they become deceased. And so basically what we began talking about even before the public health emergency was a one-time use of a large data hub, which can include commercial data, state-based data, federal data, to gather information about people who are enrolled to see if there's any evidence of change in circumstances, change in address, change in income. These data hubs are very good at being able to generate information about change in circumstances that then do have to go through their due diligence with eligibility workers to determine if they're valid. And if they are determined to be valid, can be acted upon. States have done those redeterminations and saved significant money in doing so. So we were talking about that before the public health emergency. With the public health emergency, eligibility has remained frozen, and there is now a conversation about methodologies to pursue coming out of it. Right now it's scheduled, the public health emergency is through mid-April. It can be extended again. They're extended for 90-day increments. The enhanced federal match, which is sort of the exchange for not removing people, will end 75 days after the public health emergency. And so states have options. They can just begin a process, sort of open up again and sort of incrementally once a month take the people who are supposed to be redetermined and over a period of 12 months hit the whole caseload such that you redetermine everybody at the end of 12 months. There's also a conversation to be had about a more of a risk-based methodology, which is to run this data hub and to assign scores to people that would indicate the likelihood that they may be ineligible, and to address those cases first in your redeterminations. And my understanding is the department's looking at both those options, but there's certainly either option, there will be significant savings with redeterminations coming out of the PHE. We can move on to slide 31. So just a little bit of a baseline on delivery system. So it definitely is true that across the 50 states, Alaska is much more fee-for-service than most states. Most states have implemented commercial managed care or some version of it, but there are understandable reasons why Alaska has not gone down that road. And there's many unique characteristics, including the tribal health system, and also the rural nature of the state and the difficulty of being able to establish provider networks with those health plans in those rural areas. At the same time, Alaska is making progress on this front, and things like the Behavioral Health 1115 waiver are beginning care coordination in that area, the Providence Care Coordination Initiative. So what we sought to do in our report is to make a recommendation that would make the change incremental, would not create damage or harm the system by doing something dramatic that the state is not prepared for. We can move on to slide 32. So the recommendation is to implement Section 1945 health homes. Health homes were authorized in the Affordable Care Act, Section 1945. And I wanna tell you what this term means. It's basically a provider that becomes a care coordinator is the main thing. I mean, think of it as the quarterback of the care team, and assures care coordination, assures looking across the plan to make sure that people are talking to each other, that things make sense, that there's follow-up, to help improve the overall quality of care across different provider types. Health homes specifically in the ACA are targeted at people with chronic health conditions. So you can only deliver these services to people with two or more chronic health conditions to qualify as a health home. And states can do this through just a regular state plan amendment instead of waivers. So they don't have to file for a waiver that asks to bend certain rules. They can do it right through an agreement with CMS under the current rules. And states can define the provider types that would be eligible to do this kind of work. States can decide if they want to make it regional or statewide. And so states have a lot of latitude in terms of how they can shape who can qualify to be a health home and where that's going to take place. So from our perspective, it seemed like the best gradual step forward, and there was a lot of support for it in the stakeholder feedback. A lot of excitement among providers for moving this ahead. For the care coordination elements themselves, so what I mean by that is the actual care coordination work, not the actual benefits like hospital, pharmacy, all those things. The state can get 90% matching funds from the federal government on the care coordination services for 8 quarters in setting this up. So that is the suggested reform on delivery system, and that is then in the budget, and there are associated savings that have been derived from that. We did model those savings based on what other states have been able to achieve, and if you read the full paper, you'll see footnotes that actually go to the evaluations of these health homes and show the savings that other states have been able to achieve. All right, I'd like to move to slide 33.
Before we move on, I've got a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, real fast for Mr. Albertoni. You said that they'd only need to do a state plan amendment, not a waiver, but I thought state plan amendments can also be a long process to move through. Am I wrong about that?
Well, it depends on how much detail the department and CMS have to negotiate as part of that state plan amendment. They do take a few months for sure, at the very least. And they can take a long time if there's disagreement about certain ways that the department would implement, or if CMS feels that the department's not meeting the standards that are in the state plan. So.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, so I'm on slide 33, which is titled Payment Reform. Many states start down the payment reform journey focused on hospitals, and the reason that is the case is that it does represent a large share of the overall spend for the program, and it is a relatively small number of providers, which typically makes it somewhat easy to implement and a significant impact on the program. Right now, the baseline for hospital reimbursement in Alaska is a per diem inpatient hospital methodology, and the outpatient methodology is a percent of charges. These were the methodologies in place when we were doing the study. Now, the department was already committed on the inpatient side to looking at moving away from the per diem, moving to this thing called DRG reimbursement, which stands for Diagnostic Related Grouper. And really what that does is begin to measure the actual resources that are needed to provide a service, to not just say we're going to pay you a fixed amount per inpatient day, but we're actually going to look at what you are treating, and we're going to try to measure what the resources are to treat that, the needs, and pay according to that. But the two methods as they existed were not acuity-based, meaning they didn't really measure resources. So we commend the department for looking at moving away from that. Let's move to slide 34. So the recommendation for hospital payment reform is to take a small portion of the overall hospital budget and put it into a pay-for-performance fund. We're basically recommending a small carve-out of about $3 million, which you could achieve by basically putting a budget adjustment factor into the rate setting and capping out rates at a certain amount, taking the excess, not saying it's a cut, but it's something we're going to pay out differently based on performance. Most states then tie the payment reform, to reducing hospital readmissions, which is obviously something that reduces overall cost if you can achieve it. The reform itself is usually just if you can reduce by a certain amount, you earn your payment, and that's the structure of it. And the savings that are in the budget proposal are based on effectively reducing preventable readmissions in Alaska by 25%, which would generate the state share savings that are in the budget. And that actually concludes my presentation.
Great. Do we have any questions for Mr. Albertoni before we move on to the next section? I don't see any questions. So, Mr. Wall?
Mr. Chair, at this time, I would like to hand, for the record, my name is Al Wall. I'd like to hand the presentation over to Director Moreau Johnson on the 1115.
Okay, if you can put yourself on the record.
Hi there. Thank you. My name is Jennifer Moreau. I am the Division Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, and I know we only have 5 minutes left, but I still want to thank you for the time that you've given to this topic. I'll try and move through the slides quickly because I really want to make sure that folks are aware of what we were able to accomplish so far in the ongoing demonstration project. Just to go back to Senate Bill 74, I do want to call out some language from the law. So straight from Senate Bill 74, the department is required to apply for a Section 1115 demonstration project waiver and continue cooperation with the grant-funded community mental health clinics and drug and alcohol treatment centers that have historically provided care. So as the 1115 waiver maximizes federal Medicaid matching funds, and we'll show you how, the division continues to leverage grant opportunities. And I'd just like to point to the hard work of the staff and engagement with stakeholders, and in this last year, drawing down $14 million new dollars in federal grant funds. So we continue to work towards a sustainable system of care by leveraging funds through the Medicaid state plan, 1115 waiver, and grant opportunities. If you don't mind changing, thank you, Deputy Commissioner. So the Alaska 1115 waiver, I know there was a question about waivers. One of the things that this waiver does is it targets populations. It has created specialized services for target populations. This slide represents the full continuum of care for youth and adolescents with a mental health or substance use disorder or at risk of a mental health or substance use disorder. The game changer for Alaska with this population and this waiver is that at-risk or early intervention part of the services. So what you see in this graphic is the continuum of care from early intervention to acute. The blue represents 1115 services. The orange represents state plan. The green grants. So again, we're leveraging all three as we build the continuum of care. If you don't mind moving to the next slide. Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. This slide represents the population with a mental health disorder. Again, the blue 1115, orange state plan, green the grants. And as you view this graphic, the game changer is the emphasis on step up, step down services. These services can either divert from or stabilize an individual when discharging from acute care. So this avoids acute care and provides stabilizing services in community. And I'm gonna continue to move quickly. This next slide is, thank you, is the population that experiences substance misuse disorder. And just very quickly, I'll say the game changer for this is aligning our services with the ASAM levels of care, which is the American Society of Addiction Medicine, or ASAM. And these are standards based on clinical assessments and levels of care. So this really goes to improving the quality of care through the 1115. And I'm just gonna keep moving until someone tells me to stop as I watch the clock. If you don't mind changing the slide, please. So here we're gonna start our deep dive. This slide is one service in one calendar year. This is one service under the 1115. This service was previously not billable to Medicaid. So it's critical that we track this one. This is IMD for SUD, that's IMD, Institute of Mental Disease, a facility of 16 beds or more for SUD, substance use disorder. And so this is a service that historically was funded by state grants, so note the transition to the federal Medicaid dollars. You've heard before about FMAP and federal matching funds. So this service under the 1115 is leveraging those federal dollars. Overall, the 1115 specifically is running at about 87% federal dollars. Next slide, please. Thank you. This slide is state fiscal year 2021, and it shows the federal-state split for behavioral health Medicaid. So this is overall 1115 and state plan. Just so you know, behavioral health claims represent approximately 10% of all Medicaid claims overall. And then my last slide, I'm gonna come in under the wire. If you don't mind flipping the slide, thank you very much. This slide represents the number of unique agencies billing the 1115 by region. So in the case of an agency that's serving multiple regions, that agency will appear in each region that they're serving. As you look at this uptick, note that the 1115 was authorized in two parts, behavioral health and substance use disorder. So the second part wasn't implemented until May 2021. But as we look at this slide, I do want to point out this is what we anticipated. It would be incremental. We phased in our approach, and we do, harkening back to my opening comments, we do intend and will continue to work with collaboratively with our grant-funded community providers. And I think I'm at 3:31, so thank you very much for letting me present.
Actually, my iPad here says it's only 3:28, so you're doing great. Representative Josephson has a question.
Yes, through the chair. You said, Moreau Johnson, is Moreau, right? Yes. You said that there were two parts to the 1115, mental health and substance abuse, and substance abuse did not begin implementation until less than a year ago?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, correct it the opposite way. Substance use disorder was implemented first. The federal government back in 2018 created an initiative to fast track substance use disorder 1115. So we took that opportunity, we rolled out substance misuse disorder treatment first, but our waiver was always contemplated as a whole. And so the behavioral health component was implemented in May 2021.
All right, follow? So Tom Chard, who you've probably heard of from the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, which is a network of behavioral health grantees. He and I spoke, and he said the problem with completing the transition is capacity. And I thought capacity
capacity was a metaphor for something, but it's not, apparently. He means literally the ability to treat X number of patients, and you mentioned 16. And to get there, the sense I got from talking to him was you needed to expand to qualify. Can you tell me whether I heard Tom correctly?
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that really is worth a longer conversation because, you know, I don't want to just say no, but I'm tempted to say no because there's a little bit of a crosswalk. So some services were rolled back through the state plan while services were then implemented through the 1115. It's not a one-for-one exchange, and doing it in a short amount of time is not going to do it service. It's complicated, or justice. So it's complicated. I don't want to understate that, yeah, it's hard. This transition is hard, and that's why we're phasing it in. And for a period of time, we continued to allow the state plan services concurrently with the 1115 in the hopes that that would ease transition. We continue to do things like create provisional certification opportunities for providers. You know, I think we're at a four-year provisional to get certified for certain services. So we're doing everything we can to ease the transition. But it's a difficult answer to provide in a short amount of time. Yes, it's hard. Yes, there's capacity issues. And yes, the department and division are doing everything we can to ease the transition.
Thank you.
Good. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I restrained from asking questions because you had a lot to cover. And I want to give you every chance to get through the slide, so congratulations on doing that. My question is kind of combination, question, comment, and I base it on slide number 30. And I know that was a long time ago, but looking back, and I wasn't here when Medicaid expansion happened, and that was back in 2015 or 16. What I recall being suggested is that Medicaid expansion was for a population of, 18 to 64, I think. Is that correct? And if it's not, correct me. But the Medicaid expansion population was just a safety net, and individuals in that group, the hope was that they would find employment, develop a trade, a skill, an education, and leave the Medicaid expansion world and fall into an employment opportunity that had health insurance as part of their employment. But with COVID public health emergency status, we had many individuals that were unable to find employment during the last couple years of the emergency. And is there an I guess I'm getting around to a question, is there an expectation that there's a lot of individuals that fell under the public health emergency that we will find out now has health care benefits with an employer, and that population, which saw a spike, an upward increase, is going to do the opposite and will decline, and will we have Medicaid savings here in the next year or two?
Woo. Representative LeBon, through the chair, this is Al Wall for the record. I appreciate the question, and I think that some of what you're discussing was addressed underneath the cost containment item where we talk about redetermination of eligibility, because I believe you're right. During the pandemic, when we have not been taking a look at enrollment, we will find people that found jobs that have good insurance, and they'll come off the rolls. I would also like to point out that in many cases for the expansion population, they're in a situation where they may have a job that either pays too little or doesn't offer health benefits, or maybe their health benefits are too costly to have. And so that's part of an issue that we are addressing as well. But I think that some of what you're suggesting in the patterns and trending may occur.
Just one follow-up. And I think what I heard from one or both of the presenters is that we're going to be entering a period of reevaluations or redeterminations. And if some of us are here on this committee 1 year from now looking at the next budget cycle, are we going to learn that there has been a specific number of individuals that have come off of Medicaid?
Representative LeBon, through the chair, again, this is Al Wall for the record. Absolutely. The redetermination process is actually federally mandated. So we will be going through to take a look at that that usage and enrollment, and those redeterminations will be made before next year.
And last one would be, do we anticipate that the federally declared COVID public health emergency is going to be lifted here within the next 6 to 9 months?
Representative LeBlanc, through the chair, I believe the date right now is April 15th. And I have every expectation that it will be, subject to the decision of the feds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions? Representative Josephson?
Cable news network, which I rely on, reports a 44% decline in COVID cases. But over the last week, 2,300 people are dying per day, which is a huge number. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Ms. Moreau-Johnson, I wanted to thank you for your efficiency in getting through the last few slides. I also apologize because, you know, I hate to see folks have to rush. I actually wish that we had split up this presentation so that we had this full meeting and then maybe half of the next meeting or something, so we'll make sure we work on that. I want the committee to be able to not feel like we can ask questions. We should be able to take our time and think through thoroughly through these, and so we'll try to plan these a little bit better in the future. So very much appreciated, a lot of great information, and I thank you very much. And so with that, that concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 17th at 1:30 p.m., where we will be hearing from the Department of Public Safety. So with that, we'll be adjourned at 3:36 p.m. Thank you.